The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Glenn Lowry is the guest this week as we discuss black anger, white victims of police violence, and the ins and outs of structural racism. Lowry is formerly a neoconservative, but he's now a man of the left. He has a predisposition to go slow and a strong inclination to favor reform over radical change, but he is also a very good and interesting guest. He is a professor at Brown University, a one-time contender for Undersecretary of Education. He's the author of the book The Anatomy of Racial Inequality and the host of The Glenn Show at Logging Heads TV. It's Thursday, the 11th of August, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to mention some Zero Books titles that you should go and buy and read. First off, Daniel Coffeen's Reading the Way of Things. If you're a longtime listener, then you're probably familiar with Daniel Coffeen, and his Deleuzian Guide to Reading the World is available in paperback and as an ebook. Also, Elliot Funtershell's book Zen City recently received a great review from Tangent Online, and it received a starred review in Publishers Weekly. Finally, Jerry Barnett's Porn Panic charts the rise of a new anti-sex pro-censorship movement in the UK. Our membership site is still slated to start in September to coincide with the new school year, so keep your eyes open for that. In this episode, you'll hear about functionalist assumptions in sociology, a clip from the 80s film Repo Man, E-pop's theme for Repo Man, an excerpt from a speech by O'Malley Yeshitela at the African People Solidarity Committee Conference, and an excerpt from the comedy sketch program Mr. Show. The music you're listening to right now is Wellness Plaza, the Vaporwave mix, from the YouTube star Akinin Tokyo TV. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Glenn Lowry and I discuss radical and racial politics. Glenn Lowry is the Merton P. Stoltz Professor of Social Sciences and Professor of Economics at Brown University. He's the author of many essays and books, including A New American Dilemma and The Anatomy of Racial Inequality. In 1987, he was selected to be the Undersecretary of Education under Ronald Reagan before he withdrew from consideration, and he is presently the host of The Glenn Lowry Show at Blogging Heads TV. This is his second visit to the Zero Books podcast. Glenn Lowry, thank you for agreeing to talk to me again.
It's my pleasure, Doug. Very happy to be with you.
So over the last month, you've produced 6 Blogging Heads programs in reaction to the fatal shooting of both Philando Castile and Alton Sterling. But in June or May or April, each month, you ran maybe 2 programs. What is it about the last round of police violence against black men that has inspired you to become so prolific?
Well, it wasn't only the killings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. It was also the shooting of those police officers in Dallas that partly accounts for the reason I was giving so much attention to this. But in general, I guess I had the feeling that things were coming to a head, and I wanted to educate myself as well as to try to provide some broader discussion of these issues for the audience of The Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv. I have this ongoing colloquy with John McWhorter, the linguist at Columbia University. He and I do one of these conversations every 6 weeks or so, just as a matter of course. And 2 of the ones that you called attention to were with McWhorter. But there were some other people that I wanted to hear from. Peter Moskos, the professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, who's the author of a book called Cop in the Hood, and is a former Baltimore City police officer with a PhD from Harvard in sociology. I really wanted to get his perspective. Heather McDonald is a conservative writer. Her book, The War on Cops, just came out recently. She is a proponent of the so-called Ferguson effect, which alleges that crime has been accelerated to some degree in cities because police are holding back because they fear that they're going to get into trouble if they do their jobs. And I wanted to hear from her. Harold Pollack is a liberal social policy expert at the University of Chicago and a former student of mine, actually, going way back to the 80s. I wanted to hear from him. So I just found myself having these conversations. And it's summertime, Doug. You know, the living is easy. So it's much preferable to doing real work.
Right, there you go. Well, I found it to be very helpful and interesting to watch your show and to hear from all of the people that you just mentioned. But the programs that stuck with me the most, I think it was because I was a little outraged maybe by it, were the conversations you had with John McWhorter. In the first program on this topic with John McWhorter, he insisted that the shootings had to be understood as involving a racial element, which I think is something that's obvious to most people, but which, due to the nature of your show and the politics that both you and McWhorter share, was a premise that had to be interrogated. But he came to this conclusion, there was a racial element. What I found most interesting about that was that he agreed with Toni Morrison, or seemed to take a similar stance to Toni Morrison, the one she took in April of 2015. Morrison said that she believed that racism is over when she saw a white man convicted for raping a black woman. And McWhorter said, or he asked for a list of the dead white people who were killed by the police without justification. Now, to me, this seemed like a really low bar to, you know, jump over to prove that racism is over in both cases, that there certainly could be a racial component, a very strong racial component to the shootings, and still there might also be a list of dead white men and vice versa in the rape case. So what do you think was behind these kinds of requests? What is the thinking there? Because it seems sort of outrageous. It seems to me like it overestimates the level of white privilege by quite a lot to make those kinds of demands.
I would want to distinguish here in responding to that question between a kind of, if you will, statistical or social scientific assessment on the one hand, and more of a kind of discursive narrative, what's the big story, never mind the numbers perspective, on the other. Okay, so I failed to mention in previous response to you that one of those conversations, the six that you mentioned that I did have, was with Rajiv Sethi. Rajiv Sethi is an economist at Barnard College, Columbia, and has acquainted himself very closely with a lot of the statistical analysis that does attempt to assess the question, the very specific question: if the persons harmed by the police had been white, would that event not have occurred? Okay, so that's a kind of hypothetical. It's a little bit like, if I see that people are being paid differently and I want to know whether or not there's discrimination in employment in the wages that people are paid, let's say women get 70 cents on the dollar on average compared to men, let's just say. The question is, if the employee had not been a woman, had been a man, would she have been paid more? That kind of hypothetical. And it turns out that just looking at the averages doesn't answer that question, because women may be, in the example at hand, I'm not saying this is true, I'm just saying it could be true, maybe earning 70 cents on the dollar because they have lower attachment to the labor force, or because they choose occupations which on average are paid less well, or for other reasons like that that are not implicated in just flat out discrimination. So you'd have to control for that. And likewise, with respect to the police and the killings of citizens, these cases that we hear about in which black people have lost their lives to police violence, they well might not be indicative of the fact that the police acting in that circumstance acted differently because of the race of the person. There may be other factors, and we could go into them, that account for that difference. So that's a kind of, you know, narrow reading of the question that asks about the counterfactual issue of if the person's race had been different, would they have been treated differently? Now, I think most people intuitively think that that's so, think that, in fact, when we see blacks being killed by the police, part of the reason why is that there's some, maybe most of the reason why is that there's some animus, bias, misperception, contempt for the value of the life of the person who has been killed that's linked to their race. But demonstrating that as a statistical matter is harder. So that's the statistical question. The question of discursive narrative is different, though. The killing happens. There's a video. It gets in the news. It gets it goes viral. People start getting agitated. They talk to one another about it. They begin to weave those events into a larger narrative about the character of race in American society, about what the history of police violence has been, about the long ago history of slavery and how blacks have always been had to be penned in and so forth and so on. And that kind of thing can take on a life of its own, untethered from the, if you will, objective, if you will, scientific assessment. So in making this distinction, what I'm trying to do is situate McWhorter's comment by observing that I think he's mainly talking about the latter, the discursive and narrative, and not the former, not the statistical and social scientific interpretation of these events. He's mainly saying, I think, with a movement like Black Lives Matter in the streets, demonstrating and so on, with all manner of commentary coming forth about the bias of the police, about the racism of the police, about the devaluation of black life, I understood him mainly to be saying, I think that's right. I think we are seeing something here that is largely about race in America. And to the extent that someone like myself might take issue with that, might say, well, not so fast. There are whites who are getting killed, too. His response is, well, show me the list. Tell me who the white people are getting killed. Really? I saw Walter Scott in South Carolina running on video. I saw him running away from a police officer who pulls out his weapon, shoots him in the back entirely unnecessarily so, and then lies about it. You think there's some white cases that are like that? I saw Eric Garner struggling with cops. He's doing nothing but standing in front of a store selling loose cigarettes, and he ends up being choked to death. You're telling me that there's some white people that has happened to? I saw Tamir Rice in a park in Cleveland, a 12-year-old boy playing with a toy. Officers pull up, and before anybody knows what's going on, really, they shoot him to death. You think there are white people that that's happening to? To me, that's what McWhorter was saying. And the answer to his question is yes, there are.
right, exactly.
But of course, you're also right, Doug, to say that that doesn't prove that blacks are not being discriminated against. It doesn't prove it, no, but it's nonetheless noteworthy to point that out.
Right. Well, I don't quite understand why you need the counterfactual. Like, my understanding is that the critique from anti-racists or from from people who are very concerned about overcoming racism in America isn't that the problem is personal prejudice or that the problem is the way that people think about race primarily, but that there's a structural racism at work. So you can you don't need a counterfactual. You can say, yes, it's true that if a white person's in the same situation, he too or she too would have been shot, and yet still say, but this happened to these people because they were black. Because you can say the circumstances, the structural circumstances that put so many of these people in this position has to do with race and the history of racism in the United States. So the statistics matter. The fact that it's disproportionately falling on black people to be the victims of police shootings this way matters, even if we don't need Ku Klux Klan members who are police actually pulling the trigger.
Well, yes. But then the remedy that you would seek for the disparity by race that comes about as a consequence of the structure, as you put it, would depend upon what in that structure is actually, bringing about these events. The remedy of police misbehavior, that is, we got the cop who choked Eric Garner to death needs to be convicted. Police officers need to wear body cameras. We need to have less influential police unions lurking around whenever we need to have civilian review boards that have real power in order to hold the police accountable. Mm-hmm. We need to train the police better and so forth. That's all about police behavior. Mm-hmm. If the issue is we've got housing projects on the wrong side of the tracks where poor people have been piled in, there are no jobs for kids. Schools don't function, so young people are coming out without skills that allows them to be employable. They end up getting into trouble, getting into association with people who are involved in shady deals. There are too many guns on the street. People have these guns. They get incorporated into the disputes that they have personally. It ends up with high rates of homicide, et cetera, et cetera. If those are the structural conditions that the history of the political economy of the United States has left a very large number of people who descend from slaves in social backwaters where, because of all of those conditions, they're more likely to get into encounters with police that lead to them being shot, then reforming police behavior won't even begin to solve that problem. Marching in the middle of the street every time a black person, whether they were justifiably or not shot by a police officer, marching in the street, another black man has died, we've got our banners waving Black Lives Matter. Well, if indeed it's police bias that is bringing about those circumstances, maybe that's the antidote. But if it's some deeper structural, political, economic arrangements that have had the consequence of black people being overrepresented, that kind of activity wouldn't be very productive.
In part one, we looked at why young working class people, young men in particular, commit crime. We looked at the different strain theories that are based on Merton's original theory. This concluded that all subcultures are committed to money success. In this way, subcultures are seen as a reaction by male working class lads' inability to obtain this goal. Other sociologists utilize these concepts but do not share such functionist assumptions. Focal concerns and Walter Miller. Miller doesn't see the deviant behavior happening due to the inability of the lower class groups to achieve success, but rather, Miller explains crime in terms of the existence of a distinctive lower class subculture. This social class has for centuries possessed their own culture and traditions, which are fundamentally different from those in the higher classes. Miller suggests working class youth subculture has developed a series of focal concerns which give meaning to
the life of itself. Yeah, I'm here, man. The lights are growing dim. I know a life of crime led me to this time, hey. And yet, I blame society. Society made me what I am.
That's bullshit. You're a white suburban punk, just like me.
But it still hurts.
I was riding on a concrete slab, down the river of a useless lab. It was such a beautiful day. I heard a witch doctor say,
So I agree with everything you just said. The only thing I would add is that you've left out another kind of structural reason that might put black people at a disadvantage and put them into these situations more often, and that has to do with the way the economy runs and requires a reserve army of the unemployed, to put it in Marxist terms, and that there's a sort of a permanent underclass built into a capitalist economy, and for historical reasons it's convenient to have black people fall into that position, shoulder that burden. That would be another structural reason, right?
Let me push back a little bit. I'm an economist, and I'm not a Marxist economist. I have read Capital and studied Marxian thought. But it's not my it wouldn't be my first analytical toolkit to try to draw out here. Reserve army of the unemployed. So is that really what the black marginal classes of unemployed and surplus populations in the city surplus relative to the labor market, not engaged in the labor market? Is that really what they are? I mean, what do you say about immigration in that context? There's already, if you will, a reserve army of the unemployed. It's called the vast population of people south of our border who might want to come here and work. Well, why do we need to have a sort of lumpen proletariat underclass of blacks in the cities when we've got massive reserve laborers sitting just across the border?
I think you should read Capital again, because not because you know, your question isn't a really good one, but because I'm sure, you know, having your skills as an economist, you would be able to answer your own question better than I'm going to be able to. You know, I know that this is your forte. But my understanding is that that when it comes to labor and labor power, there's two questions that you have to ask. One is, you know, how many people are employed, and the other is what kind of level of wages can you get away with, and what does it take to reproduce the worker? Which is what it takes to, that's what determines the wages. So for an American citizen living in the United States as a, you know, as a free citizen, legal citizen, the kinds of commodities that it takes to reproduce that worker is higher. And, yeah, you know, the immigrants, it would be much less expensive. So you can have a need for low wages or low amount of labor power spending.
And, I get it.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a sociologist called Roger Waldinger. He has a book called How the Other Half Works, which is a very close study of the low-end labor market, low-skilled labor market in Los Angeles. I mean, he looks at like six different industries: hospitals, hotels, restaurants, furniture making, textiles, and interviews employers and, you know, gets census data, and he does a good job. And one of his points is that the employers prefer the foreign workers because they're less likely to unionize, as it were. They don't know their rights. They don't have, like, the political capital. If they're undocumented, they're kind of provisional, and, you know, they're docile, and they're easily exploited. And that the domestic-born, American-born, African-American workers are tougher to exploit in that way. So that supports what you just said. I would only add this. That's on the demand side of the labor market. That's the employers. That's what they want.
Yeah.
But it doesn't explain, if you will, the supply side of the labor market. And I'll put this crudely, and maybe I'll get into trouble for saying so, but why would African-American people collaborate in the capitalist, if that's what it is, scheme to keep wages low and whatever? In other words, why would you leave school at 16 without really knowing how to read? Why would you not avail yourself of the opportunities that we know exist in the society to elevate your position? I understand this kind of pull your bootstraps up language is ideologically offensive, but I'm really trying to ask a social science question. I mean, it's not true about every marginal population in American history, including some of the European immigrant populations that came earlier in the late 19th, early 20th century, that while they may have started as a reserve army of labor or a marginal population easily exploited by capitalists, they didn't remain that way. So don't we have to ask some questions of African-Americans ourselves as to why it is now 50 years after the 1960s civil rights upsurge, we find ourselves still, too many of us, in this extremely, vulnerable and marginal position?
I don't know. My question is just a factual one. Isn't it the case that more and more African Americans are going to college?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if the trend really supports this idea that black working people aren't trying to better themselves and get ahead. I think they are, mostly, you know. And just like, but the problem is that the jobs aren't always there, and it's very easy to, you can fall into the criminal class or be part of the, I mean, you don't have to be criminal, part of the criminal class to be part of the reserve army of the unemployed at all. But you can do either of those things and have a, you know, a good education.
Sure, although I don't think many of the African-Americans who are imprisoned in the United States have good education.
Right, no, you're right. You're right. You know, yeah.
But I want to be clear. I'm not saying people aren't trying. I'm not making some blanket accusation that blacks have just, you know, given up. I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, I, you know, more people are going to college. More people are in prison. You know, the landscape is bifurcated in some ways. Elijah Anderson, I don't know if you know his work, the sociologist at Yale. He's an ethnographer. He spends his time just, you know, having conversations over coffee with people or going into their kitchens and, you know, developing relationships. And they confide in him about their lives. And then he writes it up. He has a book called Code of the Streets. In this book, he develops this notion of, he says, in the black communities that he studied, mostly North Philadelphia, there are what he calls decent families and street families. Very crude words, but he says they're the words that his informants, the people he's interviewing, use themselves. So the decent families are pressed. They don't have any money. The cops are harassing them. Their living conditions and public services and so forth are not that great. But they still kind of believe that, you know, if they keep their nose to the grindstone and so forth, they'll get ahead and things will be better for their kids. And the so-called street families have kind of a much more jaded view about authority. They resolve their disputes more by violence. They're, you know, less connected to church and family and stuff like that. Again, this is a kind of stick-figured characterization. I don't mean it to be a rich and robust description of the landscape. But I just, the position I'm trying to defend here is that in addition to the imperatives of capitalism and the operations of a labor market, there is also, if you will, a social economy. I almost want to use the word culture, although I know it's a word in bad odor in many quarters. There's a dynamic that goes on inside families and communities in which people's response to the conditions that they confront are not predetermined. And there's more than one path there. And it may be worthwhile to ask about parents who don't know where their children are at 10 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night. How can you expect your kids not going to end up in trouble if you're not exercising enough of a kind of parental discipline and control? Now, the parent will be overwhelmed. Maybe it's a single mom. Maybe there's six kids around. Maybe there's no money. Maybe, you know, they're stressed and so forth and so on. But still, there really is no substitute, is there, for effective parenting that instills a certain kind of, et cetera, et cetera. Will I be blaming the victim if I call attention to the social economy on the supply side of the labor market? I'd like to think not, but I know that's what some people will say about me.
I listened to your lecture about this topic. When did you – you know, I watched it on YouTube, and I didn't keep close track of where you were and what the context was in which you were speaking, but you gave a long – kind of personal lecture about exactly this issue. And when I had finished listening to it, I thought, you know, Lowry just is in a bind, and it's not a bind that's just for the black community, or it's like a philosophical problem. It's if you think that the conditions that you're living in are causing you to be a certain kind of person, which I think is basically the case, not just for black people or white people or Americans, but just as kind of the case. Like, I believe that the kind of world that we create, the conditions that we create and that we find ourselves in create us. So if you feel that that's the case, how do you then take responsibility for changing those conditions? It's a problem. It's like, to me, it's a paradox. And I think that's the issue that you're talking about there. It's not you certainly can't do it by staying within the structure of power and the economy that you're in. You're never really going to solve that, at least as a group, that way. But at the same time, if you don't work as an individual, if you don't make personal choices and try to be responsible as an individual, you'll never make a huge social change either. So.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. The lecture you're calling attention to was given at Brown University as a part of the Brown International Advanced Research Institutes which is a two-week summer workshop that brings 150 or so younger scholars from around the developing world, mostly Asia, Latin America, and Africa, into the campus at Brown to, you know, study different kinds of things. And I was one of the faculty members as a part of the Institute, and that was a plenary session lecture that was put on by the Institute back in early June. Mm-hmm. On the philosophical problem, I recognize it. I mean, it reminds me a little bit, and I'm no philosopher, but it reminds me of Kant, of this, of trying to come to grips with this issue of how do you have moral responsibility in a world in which people's behavior is conditioned mm-hmm. by all manner of things, from the genes that they inherit to the environmental influences that act on them in one way or another. And yet you still need to be able, do you not, to find some ground on which you can hold people responsible for either behaving morally or not having done so. I mean, every action at some level maybe is predetermined. I mean, maybe at the end of the day, there really is no such thing as free will. It's all an illusion. Even the acts that we think we're undertaking, like I used to be a drug addict and I'm not anymore. That's me. That's an actual truthful report about Glenn Lowry. I'm no longer a drug addict. I used to be, or I used to use drugs out of control, and I no longer do that. Mm-hmm. It's been 25 years, you know, knock on wood, I'm okay.
Yeah.
But my ability to get out of using drugs, which I might want to attribute to my free will, you know, I had the courage, I had the toughness, I had the, you know, whatever. It may be that that very so-called courage and toughness to, you know, go through the process that you need to go to recover from addiction is itself determined by environmental things. And I deserve no credit for not being an alcoholic or not being, you know, high on cocaine or whatever it is right now. I simply was the beneficiary of having been endowed with these influential environmental or constitutional factors. So I thought that the way Kant resolved that problem, I repeat, I'm not a philosopher. Uh-huh. Any of your listeners, if I get this wrong, should just give me a little slack.
Right.
Was to say there's no possibility for any kind of moral science if we don't presume. I thought he kind of made an assumption.
Yeah.
To the effect that, you know, we might as well give up the ghost and forget about talking about moral philosophy unless we presume at some level that there is a self down inside all this environmentally conditioned stuff that is capable of making choices of this kind. And likewise, I kind of want to say, if I look at low-income, black, urban, you know, segregated ghetto, high crime area, high in and out of jail populations, communities. And if I say about them, well, they basically have no choices. I mean, look how they are situated within the larger political economy. What can you expect? At some level, I'm not taking such people seriously if I say that about them, notwithstanding the fact that there's much truth in the observation and notwithstanding the fact that politically we ought to try to make the environment better for them, make the possibilities, the structure more open and fair to them. Those are things that are true about us. But about them, if I say they have no choices, am I not at some level refusing to take them seriously as human agents? And how can they ever be equal? How could they ever be equal citizens if they're not going to be taken seriously as human agents? If a mother has five kids by four different husbands, is not typical. This is meant to be an extreme example. I'm not saying that this is typical. But if indeed she does, and I say about her, well, she really didn't have any choice. No. I mean, really? What have I reduced her to? She's not just a chit. She's just a cog in a machine. She's not a moral agent. She's not a human being if I say about her that she had no choice.
What I want to say to that person is not only did she have the choice not to make the, you know, not to have five kids that way, but she also had the choice to try to change her conditions.
Yeah.
That's... You know, that's
about political agency.
Yeah,
now.
Right. Yeah. You know, the that's why something like the Black Panther Party was so incredibly helpful, because it was all about taking responsibility not only for your own personal lives, but for the political conditions you found yourself in. And so, I mean, I'm not any kind of a historian. I don't know everything about the Black Panther Party, and I don't think ultimately I would side with all their politics. But I kind of see that having that political side to the question has to be there for people to take responsibility for themselves when they're in those conditions. They have to not only say, I can take care of myself, I cannot have four kids, but I can take care of myself and take care of my community and try to change these conditions. That's, in fact, my responsibility, is to do those things.
I see.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Actually, it's very interesting to me because, I mean, it's instructive is perhaps the right word, not just interesting. It's instructive to me because I've been reacting to Black Lives Matter in a particular way, critically. Mm-hmm. I've been saying, yeah, I get it, okay. But I've been saying, one of the things I've been saying is that it's not just blacks who are being mistreated by the police. There are a lot of whites, twice as many whites as blacks are killed by the police every year. That's true. Now, you know, there are many more than twice as many whites than blacks in the population, so the rate is higher for blacks. Mm-hmm. But many whites are being killed. As we were mentioning earlier in this conversation, John McWhorter wanted to see the list. Well, there is a list. And, you know, there's a large number of people on it who have been shot by police in terrible circumstances. And I've been saying, make league with the whites and don't make this into a racial issue. And I've been saying that out of a kind of ordinary politics in which I imagine that in a country that is governed by the majority, if you're a minority, you need to get people who are not in your minority group on board with you. And what better way to do that than to frame the question of police violence in generic and not racially specific terms? That's what I've been saying.
Yeah.
What I may be missing is that these whites who are being mistreated and being killed by the police and who are more numerous than the blacks are basically politically empowered. And taking whites as a class, and maybe one shouldn't do that, but in any case, mm-hmm. there isn't really a problem of the police departments not being responsive to them or of them feeling that they don't have the capacity to change the structures in which they are living to the extent that they were moved to do so. And the establishment of a sense of political agency in the majority population isn't a problem. But for African-Americans, especially people who are economically marginalized and who are disproportionately being placed in this situation, the first order of business is to kind of get people standing on their feet and in some organized way aware of their circumstances and become determined to change them. And that kind of, which the Black Panther Party in the 1960s and 70s, in my recollection, certainly constituted, it was an awakening kind of thing. And that kind of assumption of a mature agency in terms of the political environment that one is embedded in and the an ability to act collectively on behalf of one's interests may be prior to the coalition politics that's needed in a democratic majoritarian political order in order to get a law passed or something like that.
Kind of scares me a little bit to think that race is going to be the foundation for the identity that you adopt to then, you know, use as your foundation to change the world. I don't tend to like that. And I don't tend to like that as a white person, because when white people do that, it's really scary. You
know,
that's not what you want to see white people do at all. So now it's not the same when black people or other people who are oppressed minorities do it, but the white people who tend to turn to their race as the foundation for their politics are not the most empowered people in the country. You know, these are not people, by and large, these are people who might be having four kids with five different husbands, if that was possible.
I think it's five kids with four husbands, weren't husbands, but never mind.
Right. But, yeah.
No, I hear you, man. I'm reading this book, Hillbilly Elegy. Do you know this book?
I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I just got my hands on it and I picked it up. It's very interesting. In any case, it's about, if you will, the white underclass, how marginal they are and how bad conditions have gotten, not just in Appalachia. I mean, did you know that the number of white women in prison since 2000 has risen by 50%?
I did.
The number of black women in prison has actually gone down by a quarter since 2000. In the last 15 years, the number of white women in prison has risen by half again, and the number of black women in prison has fallen by a quarter. Angus Deaton at Princeton, the Nobel laureate economist, has got demographic data showing that the one segment of the population in which life expectancy is actually going down significantly in the United States are working in lower class, poorly educated white people in the United States. Yeah. There's a huge heroin epidemic, which we hear a lot about, that is afflicting particularly lower income and lower working class white communities, much more so than African Americans, going on right now in the country. So, you know, there's a lot of reason to think that some of the same structural barriers that adversely affect blacks are also adversely affecting some whites.
Yeah.
It also seems to me, if I now I'll conclude, that Donald Trump's appeal to this white nationalist kind of a proto-nationalist kind of sentiment is connected somehow to identity politics. I'm not casting aspersions. I'm not pointing blame. I'm just trying to say historical causation wise. In other words, if you live by the identity politics sword, maybe you run the risk of dying by it.
Yes.
If you call attention to everybody else's race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and so on, maybe you invite the excluded category to start looking at themselves in terms of their race and gender and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
And you end up with a proto-fascist kind of racial nationalism that I don't think anybody should welcome.
Yeah. There's an article in The Atlantic, I think today, or on The Atlantic website called Why Trump Supporters Think He'll Win. And a big portion of that essay or article is just a transcript of a Trump supporter. And he says exactly that. He says, you know, white men are going to start thinking like a class, like an oppressed class. And we will support Trump as long as he's supporting us.
Wow. And,
yeah, it's frightening.
Yeah.
You know? And I do think, and I get probably, I allow my emotions to get the best of me and not in the best way sometimes, but I get upset with a lot of my comrades or allies on the left when they are so quick to press that button on identity politics and so quick to dismiss people based on them being white men. I just feel like not only is it not right, but it's really hurting themselves. They're setting up reaction. You know, they're setting up their own demise every time they do that. And that is a way for me to segue to Michael Eric Dyson's essay in the New York Times.
Yeah. Open letter to white people.
Yeah.
I saw it.
What did you make of that?
And I read some of the comments, too. There were many, many, many comments. And, you know, time is limited. I didn't much care for it, Doug. I thought it was a little bit, in a way, kind of morally high-handed, supercilious, self-righteous. I thought lecturing white people that they don't get it and that they can't understand. I thought some don't get it and some don't understand for sure, but it's not because they're white. And it's not a statement about whiteness leaving them incapable of understanding. I kept, as I read the article, replacing white with black and black with white and wondering how those sentences would sound. And they would sound like something off of an alt-right ultra-nationalist website is what they would sound like. I mean, and I kept thinking, if I were to read an article, open letter to black people, can you please raise your children? I would think it was racism. You know, so I thought that. And the other thing I thought is, how do the editors at the New York Times put this on their editorial page? I think it was on a Sunday at the top of the page or something like that. I'm saying, man, who's in charge over there? Don't you all have any – are you so enraptured by this moment of upheaval, you know, with Black Lives Matter and so forth, and you're so eager to be on, quote, the right side of history, close quote, that you've suspended your own editorial judgment and you don't have enough kind of distance and objectivity to be able to see that this is problematic in the ways in which I've been describing. So that's what I thought.
That's last question about the editorial board at the New York Times is one that's really troubled me as I've watched not just the New York Times, but the New Yorker and the Atlantic and other places. Seem to devolve into, I don't know, kind of clickbait style journalism. And I wonder, like, was there a generational shift that happened? First of all, I'm 45 now. I'm getting old.
I'm checking the field for you. I got it. You can't see it, but right now it says, it took me 67 years to look this good. That's what my t-shirt is saying. Right. So.
Well, like 45, you start to realize it's happening. I imagine by the time you're 67, you've come to some sort of peace with it. But the fact is that I know that my standards for these things are based on probably misunderstanding and misreading of the New Yorker back in the 80s, thinking more of it than I should have back then, thinking it had a higher standard. And there's always a tendency as you get older to think, oh, things were better then. But this does seem remarkable to me that that this would be in the New York Times.
There's a kind of echo chamber thing going on, or whatever it is. I mean, the figure Ta-Nehisi Coates, he wins a National Book Award for his memoir Between the World and Me, and he becomes lionized and celebrated, a MacArthur genius and so forth. I'm told that at the New Yorker, I'm told this by an insider. I don't want to name this guy because it was a private conversation, but this is somebody who knows the New Yorker. He's a staff writer at the New Yorker. I'm told that he's untouchable, that when a brilliant essay that ultimately was published in the London Review of Books by a man called Thomas Chatterton Williams, who is an African-American who lives in Paris, and he's a philosopher, and he wrote a review of Between the World and Me, which I regard to be brilliant, and anyone can find it in the London Review of Books, and it basically was the agency issue. It argued that Coates's bleak vision of the American racial landscape, in which he was telling his son, in effect, game over, no chance for black people in this country, your life ain't worth a damn, the whole country's built on despising and denigrating you. Williams, this man I'm speaking of, argument in this, what I regard to be brilliant review, was that that was a not only bleak, but it was also a profoundly disempowering view of the situation, because it deprived African Americans of agency. It was a no exit, hopeless, this is our fate, brace yourself for it outlook, which the author thought not to be appropriate. Anyway, what I'm trying to tell you is the essay sat for months at the New Yorker. And ultimately, the editor in chief there, a man we all know is called David Remnick, killed it. Okay, because you can't, says my informant, criticize Ta-Nehisi Coates in the pages of the New Yorker, because damn it, the New Yorker and its readership are going to be on the right side of history no matter what. Which felt to me like, okay, to the extent that therefore you stop offering your readers deeply critical and interesting engagement with what are profoundly controversial issues, and instead you become a cheerleader. That I offer as a piece of evidence on behalf of the proposition that the cultural spaces in certain corners of American letters are not exactly open to argument on these points.
What is Coates saying? What is he really giving up on? What game is over when he says that kind of thing, or when he writes of saying that to his son? Is he saying that black struggle is over? He doesn't really want to say that, does he? So what game is he?
No, he's saying the American dream is over. He's saying, you know, have you read the book?
No, I haven't read that book.
Okay, yeah. So I can't do justice in, you know, this brief conversation to what is an argument. But he's basically saying, don't drink the Kool-Aid. It's never been about what, the magnificent promissory note that Martin Luther King talks about, the American dilemma that these are my words. These are not his references, but this is my reading of what he's saying, that Gunnar Myrdal identifies, you know, at mid-20th century America coming to terms with its ancient problem of whatever. So it's an illusion. It's a delusion. If you believe in America, if you really believe that the blacks are not all that different from the Irish or the Jews or the Italians and that we'll be able to make our way too, if you really relax and get secure and think that because you graduated from Harvard or Columbia or somewhere, because you're a CPA or you have a law degree and you can cast a ballot, even a ballot for a black American president, that anything has changed. If you really believe that, if you really believe in America, you're a fool cruising for a bruising. And sooner or later, Some white guy's going to pull up in front of you and disrespect you. And when you allow yourself to get angry, a cop's going to come along and shoot you in the head. That's what he said. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe in America. This country is not for you. It's never going to accept you. You are it's as American as apple pie to want to hang your body from a tree and pull your limbs off one by one and cut your testicles and stick them in your mouth. Again, my words, but that's basically what he's saying. It's as American as apple pie. That's what America is.
Well, that leads to a kind of a separatist. I mean, obviously, that has to lead to a separatist politics, right?
Well, you would think that if there were going to be any politics that comes out of that, that's where it would lead. But yeah. Again, Thomas Chatterton Williams is making this point that there is no politics implicit in Coates's bleak landscape. But there's no pointing toward a politics there that I can see. I suppose, though, that if you thought the system was rigged and you ultimately had no place in it, even if you were to ascend to the highest office in the land by popular plebiscite – and be reelected to that office, still you don't have any power here, then of course you would be looking for some kind of divorce from the body politic and as it were to go your own way. But, you know.
In 1966, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which at that time was, I believe, the leading, most dynamic force within the so-called civil rights movement and was the bridge in this country at the moment from the civil rights movement to the actual anti-colonial black liberation movement in this country. In 1966, the civil rights movement, SNCC, expelled the white members of the organization, and telling them that you should go back to the white community. That's the source of all the contradictions, all the problems, all the so-called racism. We want you to go there. And it was because the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee became conscious in its own efforts that the struggle of African people was for self-determination. It asked the members of the white organizers to leave because there were there is this relationship that exists in the world and in this country between Africans and white people that meant that white people in the organization had all of the expertise. If someone, they were the only ones who knew how to type because they were the only one who had education in this country, had that kind of experience. So the struggle of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was confronted with was one of how, having come to the conclusion that our struggle is for national liberation, how do we liberate not only the African people in general, but how do we liberate the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee so that it can play a major role in this process? And it concluded that what was fundamental was that the struggle had to be led by African people ourselves, and that in terms of the struggle for self-reliance and that genuine support from whites meant that whites should go.
If we work together, people, we can return America to her God-given glory. America first!
America first!
Okay. Now here's what, this is what America's going to look like after the mandatory relocation is enforced. New York City will become known as Little Israel. I figure all the Jews will love that. Is that okay, Ms. Shapiro?
That's fine, Ken.
Okay. Now down here is going to be your new Africa. See, your colors keep to that. They get up in them.
Ken, I don't see a Virginia there.
Oh, well, Chris, that was going to be part of Homo Arabia, which is over there. You know, see them homos get to sodomizing.
Yeah, I'd kind of like to be by the beach.
Well, okay, I guess the color, it's going to have Virginia, too. We'll annex that.
Ken.
Yeah.
Ken. Where's Homo Arabia now?
Well, Josie, I was going to give it, I guess we could. And how about Mississippi? That's good. That's good.
Ken, you had promised the West Coast?
Well, yeah, but I'm going to need that. I'm going to need that for New Delhi, for them damn Indians.
Where will you go, Ken?
Well, hell if I know, Regent. I mean, you know, I was going to be over here, but the gays got it, so I guess I'll annex this, move this over, I'll be here with the rest of the white race in New America.
Will you keep in touch?
Of course I will, Regent. You've been a dear friend, and I'll miss you terribly. All of you. Okay?
Let's all promise to call and write often and use the internet for once.
Okay.
Email.
I'll get a webpage site.
Okay, okay. But let's stay focused, people. Okay, now our next act will be called Operation Hell on Earth.
When you talk to, when you look at like, and I don't know all of them, but when you look to like African Marxist parties in the United States or different kind of sectarian radical left groups that are based on race and usually, you know, black groups, they're almost all separatist.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are reasons for it. And I don't, they're not entirely wrong. I mean, the answer is wrong. I can't abide nationalism or separatism, really, on that level. But, I mean, I can abide nations, but that kind of nationalism I don't abide, just like I don't like it in Trump. But there are reasons for it, and it has to do with the horrific history that, you know, you just encapsulated.
There's a brilliant book, Doug. It's by a man called Wilson Moses. And it's called Afrotopia, and it's a intellectual history of separatist intellectual and political thought in amongst blacks in America, going all the way back to the late 18th century. And he documents and demonstrates exactly what you've been, you know, you say the sort of radical black political impulse is almost invariably a separatist impulse. And he tries to explain in historical terms, a very erudite man, how that has come to be.
Yeah, I'd like to read that. Maybe we can talk. Maybe I'll read it and we can talk about it sometime if you have time.
Yeah, you didn't do that.
But I have this last question here. We've been talking for a while. It's easy to talk to you, Glenn. So I'm really enjoying it. But I'm going to jump to the end, to the last question, because I think there's a lot here. Maybe I've been as this conversation has shown, I've been aligned with what I'll call the radical left for most of my adult life, all of it, really. And the only consensus there really is on the radical left is that we need to institute radical change. The justifications for that vary. For me, I started to think as a radical because of primarily when growing up in Colorado Springs and under the near Cheyenne Mountain, under the threat of a nuclear bomb, I felt that a world that would create these bombs had to change radically. But there, you know, the reasons that came to me too, a big one is starvation in a world where there's plenty. If we have enough to eat, but we can't feed everyone, something needs radical change. And then now, as a kind of a Marxist, I think that we have to live in a world that alienates and isolates people from their own best abilities and their own ideas, and that we should radically change to give more people, give everyone the chance to kind of fulfill their potential and to go beyond maybe the limits of what we think of as natural potential even. Anyway, there are different reasons. I'm lecturing for no reason. Here, because the point is that needing radical change has to start for this idea that we need radical change means you have to say no to what is. And I think that the radical part of Black Lives Matter wants to say no to what is. And I spoke a few weeks ago to Margaret Kimberly, who's a fellow traveler with me, is a journalist at the Black Agenda Report.
Yeah.
And her stance was that the black community needed to hold on to this rejection, this anger, even after the murder of police officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge. And for her, that anger that she wants to hold on to isn't just undifferentiated. It's not a criminal anger or antisocial or uncivilized or anything like that. It's just radical anger. I have this quote at the end of this. John Holloway talks about it in his book, Change the World Without Taking Power. He calls that the scream. It's a starting point of theoretical reflection, this negativity and struggle. I want to give you, what do you think about the need for black anger today?
Yeah, I was very challenged by that question when I read it in your email before this conversation that you sent. Yeah. Challenged by it because my instinct is not radical. I guess I'm going to have to say my instinct is conservative in a way, but I don't mean that as in terms of Republican Democratic politics. Yeah. I mean that in terms of maybe being fearful of the implications of radical change and wanting to be more incremental and reformist in my orientation. So that's my disposition.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I found very appealing in a way and attractive this observation of, you know, disconnected from cause and effect, not related to any programmatic undertaking, simply expressing my rage. And that's can be like an existential break with business as usual, necessary precondition for any subsequent effective organizing or political activity. There was something, you know, I used to be a Christian back in the day. That's one of the ways that I stopped using cocaine. I moved myself into a African-American Protestant congregation and became a devout member of it and a practitioner of the faith. And there was something radical about that in its way, not politically, but for me, being a rationalist intellectual, someone who was trained in quantitative social science, you know, an MIT graduate and things like that, that it involved a certain kind of suspension of disbelief. But it was a kind of necessary phase, I'm thinking now as I reflect on my life, that I had to go through in order to reorient myself and to bring myself. Now, this is all very personal. It's about me.
Yeah.
But there was something radical about it, something not entirely rational about it, that was implicated in the personal transformation that I, Glenn Lowry, a single individual, needed to undergo to get my life on track. And perhaps in some sense, groups of people need to find themselves quickened, inspired, mobilized through a vehicle for the expression of rage at a status quo that oppresses them. And so I was very loath to dismiss Margaret Kimberly's observations simply because I tend dispositionally to be somewhat of a you know, centrist and reformist and incrementalist. Very loath to dismiss it because these urban masses of African Americans who are being victimized by police in certain circumstances are in one hell of a corner. They're in one hell of a hole. And the incrementalist politics from the civil rights movement forward, embodied by the Democratic Party here now in the United States, elected one of our number, if you want to call the son of a white American and a Kenyan immigrant, a black man, and I do, mm-hmm. elected one of our number to the highest office. Wait, he still wasn't able to do much at all, as Cornel West has never tired of reminding us, for these people who are stuck in this hole.
Right.
So Primal Scream, I'm not gonna come out against it, even though I don't see the straight line from there. Now, the one thing I would say, and this echoes back to something we were saying earlier, is does it have to be racial? Do we have to frame the thing racially? Not that there's not racism. I understand that there's not that the history of slavery and going forward isn't implicated in the condition in the current condition. It is. But here we are in the 21st century, and as I was just observing, the political economy of the contemporary United States is crapping all over a whole lot of people who are not black.
Yeah.
So pragmatically, allies, coalitions, and so forth, but also morally, do you want to draw a line, a racial line, around your suffering and understand it and constitute it primarily in that way? I understand the attraction of that at some level, but I'm still, without having a fully systematic account of this position, reluctant to go there.
Well, I just wonder, and this is maybe not fair, but I just wonder if like someone like Michael Eric Dyson is in any position to talk about anyone's suffering. You know, I just don't think that it's right to say that this guy who's a political insider and very close to the Obama administration and, you know, writes for all these highbrow, you know, good publications, but that this is not the guy that can speak with any kind of real authority to people's suffering. And I don't think, But I mean, as a white man, I guess that maybe it's not my place to say that. But anyway,
I don't know how many community meetings. I mean, I have to tell you, this is one of the things that I very much admire about Cornel West. Yeah. He has this reputation. I'm talking about West now, not Michael Eric Dyson,
right.
And some bad blood between the two of them. But
yeah.
West has this reputation of being a gadfly and a kind of ambulance chasing guy who shows up in Ferguson to get arrested and, you know, so forth and so on, and right. Stands up on a podium. But I've known Cornel West for 30 years, and I know that he spends a lot of time in union halls and church basements, right. And whatnot like that. And that while he's an erudite philosopher, theologian guy, and he's a public intellectual with a big, big brand, he's also in touch in some ways with political organizing and movements that are on the ground. And I simply don't know enough about Michael Eric Dyson whether or not he is too. I'm reluctant. I mean, you know, I'm an ivory tower intellectual. I teach at Brown University.
Right.
They pay me very well.
Yeah.
I haven't been hungry in a long, long, long time that I've gone to bed and not felt like I had had enough to eat. I mean, like a long time. We're talking 60 years. So am I in any position? Yeah, I know some people who've spent some time in the big house. I've been in the visiting room at a state penitentiary. I got family members that used to hustle and sell drugs and, fence stolen goods and, run whorehouses and things like that. I mean, that's all. I mean, I'm not.
I fell into the trap right there, Lori, when I was saying, oh, he's in no position. That's not my politics. I don't base my decision about whether someone's right or wrong based on their, biography and whether they have the right to represent things. I don't know why I was talking that way, but it somehow I started talking that way.
I think Dyson set you off because you hated that piece. He's telling you you'll never understand what the black man is going through, and I think that offended you, and I don't blame you for that.
Yeah, right. That's what it was.